From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, for a lot of minor crimes across the country, you can avoid jail if you can afford to pay up.
It's very easy for jurisdictions to pass the cost on to the offender.
We'll also reveal what's happening in the invisible part of the internet, the dark net.
There are a lot of drug sites. They sell weapons, guns, tasers, hacking tools, and even you can hire an assassin.
And we'll unmask the GIMP, 20 years after Pulp Fiction hit movie screens. Plus, composer Ennio Morricone does spaghetti western music a cappella.
I used a coyote howl.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. First, we're returning to NPR's series Guilty and Charged. We've been exploring the growing practice of charging user fees to people who come through the court system, on felonies and even for low-level misdemeanors, like making them pay when they're ordered to wear an ankle bracelet. Those electronic monitoring devices can be an alternative to sending someone to jail, but the ankle bracelets are expensive, and the cost is usually passed on to the people who are ordered to wear one. NPR correspondent Joseph Shapiro reports.
Tom Barrett is standing outside a convenience store in Augusta, Georgia. The last time he was here, he got arrested for shoplifting a can of beer worth less than $2.
And I was debating in my head. I said, man, I really shouldn't do this. Oh, heck, I'm just going to do it. So I walked out with the beer. Nobody said anything. I thought, boy, that was easy. So I drank the beer. I walked down two blocks. Next thing I know, two cop cars came, and I got arrested.
Barrett has returned to this gas station convenience store today because he wants to go back inside and this time apologize to the owner. Barrett's been sober for months. Right now, he's nervous. But before we go into the store with him, we need to talk about what happened to Tom Barrett after he took that beer from the convenience store refrigerator. Because this is a story about how states across the country impose a growing number of fees on the people who come through the court system. Fees that can add up to hundreds or even thousands of dollars, all passed on to that defendant or person in jail or on probation, who most of the time is impoverished to begin with. Sometimes when they don't pay, they even go to jail. NPR did a nationwide survey and found that in 44 states, people can be charged fees for their own probation and parole supervision. At least 41 states allow people to be charged room and board when they're in jail or prison. And one of the most common fees of all, in 49 states, that's every state except Hawaii plus the District of Columbia, there are laws to allow or even require that the cost of the monitoring device gets charged to the person ordered to wear it, like Tom Barrett.
I decided to plead no contest, and I figured I'd get 12 months probation, community service, and a fine, and I'd go home. So I went to court, and that's exactly what happened. But there was one more stipulation. Judge Watkins said, and Mr. Barrett, you're going to have a leg monitor on.
And it was going to cost him $12 a day to rent the ankle bracelet, a $50 setup fee, a $39 a month supervision fee to pay his probation officer, and the money to install a landline phone for the system to work. It was more than $400 a month.
And so the judge says, you're going to be locked up until you can arrange to have this leg monitor put on your ankle. And I'm thinking, that'll be never. I don't have the money. I absolutely don't have the money.
Barrett had been homeless until just before he stole that beer, when he moved into a subsidized efficiency apartment for just $25 a month. But even to pay for that, he sold his plasma at the blood bank. He'd once lived a comfortable middle-class life. He was a pharmacist, but he got addicted to the drugs he was supposed to be safeguarding. He lost his job, his family. There were years of run-ins with the law mostly related to public drunkenness. Now, he couldn't pay for the electronic monitor and other fees. Barrett had no money, so he went to jail.
That didn't seem like justice to me. I mean, I should not have taken that beer. I was dead wrong. But to spend 12 months in jail for stealing one can of beer, I just didn't seem right.
Normally, there'd be no jail sentence on the shoplifting charge for a can of beer worth less than $2. Barrett went to jail because he couldn't pay the fees. Now, you might be thinking, so why didn't Barrett's attorney object to all those fees? Barrett didn't have an attorney. He couldn't afford the fee for one. In Georgia and 42 other states, according to a survey by NPR and the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law, there's even a charge for that supposedly free public defender.
$50 administration fee.
Did that have an impact?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, $50 is a lot of money when you have no income. And so I figured, well, the outcome's going to be the same whether I have a public defender or not, so I might as well just plead no contest and save the $50.
Barrett was sentenced to 12 months in jail, but after 2 months, his sponsor and Alcoholics Anonymous agreed to help him start paying for the electronic monitoring. Barrett got out of jail, and that's when the alcohol monitoring bracelet, a kind of black plastic collar, was attached to his leg.
Well, the thing is, the monitor worked. The monitor was a good thing. And my life started getting better just by me not drinking.
With the monitor on, for the first time in years, Barrett was sober. But he still had to pay the high fees that went with that monitor, hundreds of dollars a month. His only income was food stamps and the $30 he made when he sold his plasma. So the fees went unpaid. After almost 6 months, Barrett was called back to court. He faced going back to jail. Only this time he found an attorney who was challenging the fees. An Augusta Superior Court judge then ruled that Barrett's monitor should come off. Last September, that judge, Daniel Craig, expanded his ruling. In court, he explained why he was putting a temporary stop to forcing poor people in Richmond County to pay for their devices.
Maybe we ought to be about the business of affording due process to Americans. Maybe we ought to be about the business of seeing to it that their rights are protected.
For people who would otherwise be behind bars, electronic monitoring returns them to family and work. For corrections officials, the bracelets save money by reducing overcrowded jails and prisons. But buying or leasing the equipment and setting up round-the-clock monitoring is expensive. It's more than $1,000 for governments to purchase some of these bracelets. George Drake is a consultant to government agencies that want to set up electronic monitoring.
It's very easy for jurisdictions to pass the cost on to the offender. No one wants to raise taxes on the public. Politicians, that's the last thing they want to do.
Most states face sizable budget deficits. So state legislators, often lobbied by the companies that make the devices, pass legislation to require offenders, an unpopular group, to pay the fees. But Drake advises government agencies that they're often better off paying the bill for the monitors, rather than chasing after money from the usually indigent offenders.
But more often than not, these offenders don't have resources, and they're paying court fees, they're paying other fines, they're paying supervision fees and restitution to the victim, and they are being set up to fail because they just cannot afford all of these fees that have been assessed to them.
This is where ScramX comes in, with both continuous alcohol monitoring and house arrest in one device.
That's a marketing video for the electronic monitoring device that Tom Barrett ended up wearing. It's called ScramX. Scram stands for Secure Continuous Remote Alcohol Monitor. It's kind of like wearing a breathalyzer on your ankle. It can measure a person's sweat for evidence of drinking alcohol. The more common electronic monitoring devices check not drinking, but a person's location. So if a judge gives a curfew to someone awaiting trial, the device can tell if they're home on time. Some devices come with a GPS unit and can tell if, say, a sex offender has been lurking near an elementary school. Companies that make the devices, in their marketing materials, tell courts and probation and parole agencies they can charge the users of those electronic monitoring devices.
Of particular importance to many courts and agencies, the ScramX service provider works directly with the offender to handle billing and fee collection.
A spokeswoman for the company that makes the ScramX says it points court systems to alternative ways of charging fees. Most courts use sliding scale fees based on how much the offender can pay, or even find grant money to help poor people pay for the monitors.
Okay.
All right,
so we're going in?
All right.
Okay.
Which brings us back to that gas station convenience store and Tom Barrett. He's trying to turn his life around. He's sober. He's taking classes at a community college.
Yeah, kind of busy, I guess.
Yeah.
And now, Barrett walks into the gas station convenience store because he wants to apologize for shoplifting that beer.
Yeah, my name's Tom Barrett. I was in here April 27, 2012, and I stole a beer. I got arrested for shoplifting. I'm here, one, to just say I'm sorry. and I need to find out what I need to do to make this situation right. I need to pay for it, but I want to make it right.
My husband will be here tomorrow morning, and I will tell him that, what's your name?
Tom Barrett.
Barrett wants to pay back the price of the beer. He says it was $1.29, but he has no money. Back outside, I give Barrett my cell phone.
Yeah, it's ringing, right? Okay. Voicemail.
He calls the blood center. He's got the number written in faded ballpoint ink on the back of his hand.
This is Thomas Barrett. I was just calling to see if my protein sample had come back from the lab yet so I can donate plasma. I'll just call back later. Thank you.
Tom Barrett will be the first to tell you that it was his substance abuse and his crimes that caused his problems. But it was his debt from going through court that seemed to mock his every attempt to recover and get his life going again. The fee after fee after fee that is now common across America. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
Get ready now as we take you on a voyage to the dark side of the internet, to be precise. There's an entire world that's invisible to your standard web browser. Parts of the internet known as the deep web, the hidden web, the dark web. The tools to get there are just a few clicks away, and more, people who want to browse the web anonymously are signing on. And that's our cover story today, a peek into the hidden side of the internet. Fans of the series House of Cards are probably already familiar with the deep web. It was worked into the plot of season 2. Here, the character Lucas gets a little crash course from one of his reporters.
Hold on, the deep web, I've heard of that.
Oh, yeah, no, 96% of the internet isn't accessible through standard search engines. Most of it's useless, but it's where you go to find anything and everything. Child porn, Bitcoin laundering, mail order narcotics, hackers for hire.
I asked Wired reporter Kim Zetter if House of Cards got it right.
Yeah, but there should be a distinction between what's called the deep web and the dark web.
Let's start there. The terms get a little murky here, but there are two main categories.
The deep web is sort of anything that's not accessible through the commercial search engines like Google and Bing. Things stored in databases that these search engines won't pick up, or things that are behind a subscription firewall like LexisNexis won't get picked up by the search engines.
Then there's the dark net, a specific part of that hidden web where you can operate in total anonymity.
There are a lot of drug sites. They sell weapons, guns, tasers, hacking tools, and even you can hire an assassin. And it's not just illicit activities. We also see political dissidents who have forums that are, let's say, off of the internet grid.
But it's not the forums for dissidents that usually make the news. If you've heard of the dark net, it's probably because of a site called the Silk Road, an underground website famously shut down by the government last fall.
They were selling, you know, just a smorgasbord of drugs, LSD, heroin, methadone. What quite often happens is the ones that get exposed, they make silly mistakes. And in this case, Ross Ulbricht, who is alleged to have been the founder and the owner of Silk Road, made some mistakes in some postings that helped identify him.
Already there's a Silk Road 2 that's popped up to replace the Silk Road. Are they safe as long as they avoid, you know, silly mistakes?
They may be, not necessarily. I mean, sometimes law enforcement gets lucky. There are sometimes ways to locate a server that's hosting. And then what happens is the server may get taken down without any arrests at all. But then it'll pop up again.
So how do you access this hidden part of the internet? Let's go back to that clip from House of Cards.
How do you access it?
It's actually pretty easy. I can show you if you want.
Yeah, curious.
You mind if I...
Go ahead.
Okay, first thing you need is Tor.
Tor is the main browser people use to access this part of the web. It's an acronym for the Onion Router. The Onion refers to the layers you go through to disguise your identity. Tor is free. Anyone can download it. It's a simple site that looks like a Firefox browser, but if you take the right steps, it's very different. When you connect to a site through Tor, your computer goes through a series of other computers and bounces around anonymously until it reaches a destination.
No one will be able to see that you're the one visiting those websites, and the websites will not be able to see that you're the one visiting them either. They will only be able to see that you're using Tor to do something.
Runa Sandvik is a privacy and security researcher. She's a former contractor with the Tor project. Normally, whenever you visit a website, your internet service provider can see that you're visiting that website. Sandvik says that if you use Tor, the location that you appear to be in will change.
You can be in DC and you can send your traffic through Germany, Sweden, and Russia, for example. And the website that you're visiting will see that someone in Russia is visiting your site, not you in DC.
So who created Tor? Some open source hacker activists, right? Nope. It was the U.S. Navy. The Naval Research Lab, to be precise. Again, Runa Sandvik.
The purpose was initially to protect the communications of the U.S. military. But the challenge here is if you have this anonymity system, and every traffic going into the system is the U.S. Navy, and everything that pops out of the system is the U.S. Navy, then you're not that anonymous. Hmm. So by opening up the system to everyone, different groups of people can hide in a big crowd of anonymous Tor users.
Now, when we hear about Tor in the news, it usually is connected with some sort of sordid activity. Do we have a sense of how much of Tor activity is about illicit activity?
No. So Tor was developed with this concept of privacy by design. There is no way you can figure out who's using Tor to do what or how many websites of a certain category exist within the Tor network.
We don't know how many of these illicit sites exist, but a new search engine accessible through Tor is starting to gather that information the way Google does. It's called Grams. Wire's Kim Zetter reported on it.
It looks exactly like Google, with the same colorful lettering and Grams. It even has an I Feel Lucky button. We tested it and it showed up some high-quality heroin. Mm-hmm. You can find guns. The listings will tell you where the seller is, what country, so you can know where it's coming from when you order it. And they were also talking about putting in customer reviews of the vendors.
You talked to the creator of the site. What was his motivation behind this?
Well, he saw that people were having trouble locating what they wanted and also distinguishing between the reputable sellers and the disreputable ones.
Now, do tools like Grams that make the darknet more accessible to more people, does that also make those areas more susceptible to being found out by law enforcement?
Yeah, I mean, the quiet sites go under the radar, and Silk Road got on the radar after it was covered by the Gawker website, and that caused people in Congress to point the Justice Department to it and demand that they do something about it. So, yeah, obviously when something becomes prominent, it's going to get into the crosshairs of law enforcement.
But Runa Sandvik says there's a lot more going on than criminal activity.
There's human rights activists, journalists, military, law enforcement, normal people. It just really depends on what you want to do.
Tor's executive director is working with victims of domestic abuse who need to communicate without being tracked by their abusers. Tor is also used by Chinese dissidents who can't access sites like Twitter, and it became a valuable tool during the Arab Spring.
We saw that the numbers were skyrocketing. For example, in Iran, Tor usage went from 7,000 users in 2010 to 40,000 users 2 years later. And in Syria, from 600 users to 15,000 users in just 2 years.
Tor use jumped again in the last year, since the revelation of the NSA surveillance program. Sandvik estimates that there are close to 1 million daily users worldwide. With Americans increasingly concerned about being monitored online by corporations or their government, that number is certain to grow. The Cannes Film Festival awarded its highest prize to a Turkish movie called Winter Sleep. 20 years ago, that same award went to this beloved film. Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. It's filled with much-recited dialogue and iconic characters, but one remains shrouded in mystery. A character without a single line.
Well, bring out the gimp.
The gimp. Clad head to toe in studded black leather with a zippered hood allowing only his manic eyes to peek through. That became one of the most controversial scenes in recent film history. It still troubles some people. But looking back, the gimp character is seen as an emblem of creepiness, an essential part of the adrenaline machine that was Pulp Fiction. Now, 20 years later, it's time to unmask the gimp. Let's welcome to the studio actor and writer Stephen Hibbert. Steve, welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
An honor to be here.
So, two hillbillies keep the gimp locked up in their basement in a footlocker.
Like you do.
Yeah, like one does, yeah. and he's their willing slave. You must be proud.
Yeah, I've kept it from the children up until this moment.
Yeah? Have you literally kept it from the children?
Not actively so, but they're 14, 12, and 10, so they're a little young for Pulp Fiction still.
But soon.
Oh, so very exciting, that sweet 16 birthday party.
So how did your involvement with Pulp Fiction start?
It started with a friendship with Quentin Tarantino, actually. At the time, I was in the Groundlings, and he used to come and do improv shows fairly often, actually.
He would perform with you?
Yeah, he used to do improvs and stuff. And it was when he was writing Pulp Fiction, and he was casting it, and he asked me if I'd like to come down and read for The Gimp. You could tell, even by the script, this was going to be a pretty special film.
The Gimp has no lines, so how do you read for The Gimp?
Show business is a funny thing. Actually, he and I did like a little psychodrama where he was, you know, being dominant and I was being passive or whatever the correct terminology is.
More improv.
Yeah, more just improv. So I got the job and it was a blast. It was 2 days' work. He just said, go nuts. So I did. And the costume helped. I think if I didn't have that mask on, you'd see I was bright red and embarrassed beyond comprehension.
And was that as uncomfortable as it looked?
Yes, very. The movie was filmed in a warehouse in Culver City.
Not far from where we're sitting right now.
Blocks. It could even be this building. I don't know. It's 20 years ago now, as you know. The set was really hot and uncomfortable, and that leather gear, plus I was padded as well. Everyone was extremely kind and acknowledged how uncomfortable that gear was.
Well, like you said, you know, it's one of those films. It's such a touchstone and credited with revitalizing John Travolta's career. Mm-hmm. A lot of actors took off. Was it hard for you being in a mask and then didn't get the recognition you deserved?
No, I mean, I didn't necessarily want to be recognized for The Gimp. I never sent out, you know, Merry Christmas from The Gimp Christmas cards. But
Gimp action figures, you don't get a cut from
there
from
is
that.
One.
Yeah?
Yeah, I don't own one. If anyone's listening would like to send me a Gimp action figure, I'd love it. The weekend it opened, I had about 20 voicemails of guys saying, I really enjoyed your performance. I'd like to take you out for a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
So I got an unlisted number. This is before the internet and all that, 20 years ago. So they had to sit through the whole end credits and catch Stephen Hibbert, write it down, go grab a phone somewhere, 411, and yeah.
Dedicated fans. Do I understand correctly, you're working on children's television at the time?
I was writing for Tiny Toons Adventures and Animaniacs for Warner Brothers, so I wrote some scripts for them as well.
You're working on this more wholesome fare
yeah.
while you're...
Well, wherever they're willing to pay me has always been my motto.
So are you, what are you doing now?
Right now I'm kind of unemployed, but I've done a lot of work with nonprofits, one in particular called School on Wheels. Semi-regular role on a Nickelodeon kid show, again, called True Jackson VP. So, you know, like everyone else, keep on fighting the good fight.
That's Stephen Hibbert. He played the Gimp in Pulp Fiction. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real lot of fun.
And can we just go out by, give us your favorite line from the Gimp. He doesn't seem to age, but Jeff Goldblum has been acting in movies and on TV for 40 years. You've probably seen him in Annie Hall.
I forgot my mantra.
The Big Chill.
Well, where I work, we have only one editorial rule. You can't write anything longer than the average person can read during the average crap.
Jurassic Park.
Must go faster.
Or dozens of other movies over the years. But here's a side of Jeff Goldblum that you might never have heard before.
I want to take you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone.
There he is on the piano, playing at his weekly, yes, weekly jazz show in Los Angeles that he's been doing for more than 15 years. We sent NPR's Tom Dreisbach to find out more.
My name is Jeff Goldblum. And, geez, I'm an actor, and as a hobby, I've always played piano.
He's also a total people person.
I consider myself a social lubricant as much as a musician, really.
To set the scene here, Jeff Goldblum is wearing a white button-down shirt, this green bow tie, tight blue pants, and slightly tinted glasses. We're in a kind of club-slash-dining room with a small stage set up with a piano, a double bass, some drums, a guitar, And Jeff Goldblum is taking me around in this sort of pre-show routine.
Let's go. Come on.
Meeting fans like Ryan Thorne and Jessica Hall.
What do you guys do?
We're musicians, actually.
Really? Here, let's sing something together.
Okay, what'd you get?
Caro mio ben, credimi almen, senza di te languisce il cor. How about that?
And these fans who come to the show are often so nervous to meet him. But by the end of their interaction with Jeff Goldblum, they act like they're best friends.
She looks like a young, wait a minute.
He does this one thing to break the ice with people. He guesses which celebrities they look like.
Who's the lady, statuesque, beautiful lady who starred with Al Pacino in Serpico?
I think he actually always says the young version of whatever celebrity he picks.
So many people, speaking of the game we were just playing, come up to me and say, hey, my whole life people have told me that I look like you. I have to tell you, this is a wide range of people in the looks department. But I always say the same thing. Oh, my gosh, well, that's so flattering to me.
That's a good answer. I think that is the only acceptable answer.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I believe in courtesy.
At one point during all this, I get to talking with the manager of Jeff's band, this guy named John Mastro.
Do you ever get frustrated and think, God, just wrap it up already? We got a show to do?
No, never. I mean, I'm amused every time. Nobody works the room like Jeff Goldblum.
So Jeff learned how to play piano as a kid growing up in Pittsburgh. And sometime back in the 1990s, and no one is sure exactly when, Jeff got in touch with John Mastro to find a small group of professional jazz players. And Jeff says when he's not acting, he'll play these very loose, weekly, unadvertised gigs around L.A.
And so we have a kind of a hootenanny or a be-in or some kind of a jam session, I guess they call it. And people seem to enjoy it. You'll see. Who knows what'll happen tonight. Maybe nothing very amusing, but I like it.
On stage, he's constantly mugging to the audience, making faces, or playing with a straw in his glass of iced coffee. He's constantly going on little riffs, like this one with his guitarist, John Story.
Like the wallpaper sticks to the wall.
Like the seashore clings to the sea.
Like you'll never get rid of your shadow, John Story.
But Jeff Goldblum, you'll never get rid of me.
One of the things people keep saying to me is he's exactly like he is in the movies. And Evan Albert, Jay Salahi, and Lucy Shanahan are basically just talking about one movie.
I mean, have you ever seen Jurassic Park?
Jurassic Park's my favorite movie since I was a little kid.
As someone born in the 80s, like, Jurassic Park was kind of up there in, like, life moments.
Really, Jeff seems uniquely beloved right now, in part because some of his biggest movies in the 1990s were childhood icons for people who were born in the 1980s. And Jeff really doesn't seem to mind that fact.
In Jurassic Park, scary in the dark, I'm so scared that I'll be eaten.
And all the band plays for 3 hours, getting looser and looser as the night goes on.
Summertime, and the living is easy. Fish are jumping, and they got it in the mud.
The show ends around midnight, and Jeff is just as unassuming about his performance as when he started.
I had no idea what we were going to do, actually. So that was all a surprise to me, and it was kind of fun, wasn't it? We had some good moments.
As I leave, there's this line of people waiting for a picture with Jeff, and he stays after the show for all of them.
Come on, let's take a picture.
And you know, if he's not up to anything else, he'll be out there again next Wednesday, working the room. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
It's impossible to imagine Sergio Leone's vision of the American West without the iconic music of Ennio Morricone. Morricone's music is inseparable from the emotional texture of an astonishingly diverse number of films. The Battle of Algiers, The Mission, The Thing, Cinema Paradiso, and so many others. He's a fixture of the cultural landscape now, but as a young composer, he was a radical. Long before the spaghetti westerns, he was working modern American sounds into his experimental ensemble called Il Gruppo Dissonanza, or Il Gruppo for short. Their approach was inspired, in a funny way, by the experimental work of American composer John Cage. I spoke with Ennio Morricone with the help of translator Roberta Rinaldi.
It started after a journey to Darmstadt because I had gone with some friends there, and we attended a class by John Cage and also a concert at the time. And what he did was really a bit odd, because you could tell he did not know the basics of music in a certain sense. And so he just, as a joke, I called these friends of mine. We went to the outside Darmstadt, and I started telling them to do kind of a sound like groans or very strange sounds, and I started conducting them. And I also did sounds myself, so I kind of did some strange voice and noise. And I was somehow teasing what John Cage had done, because at that time we did not understand what he was trying to do and what he did.
So it began as a joke?
Yes, it actually started as a joke, but then the idea we all had about using the instruments was not to play the instruments as they should have been played, but to play them also raping them in somehow. Making strange sounds and strange noises, and that's how we created the Gruppo Nuova Consonanza.
L'inizio del gruppo di professor Nuova Consonanza.
What's amazing about that music, listening to it now, it sounds so modern still, and I'm wondering if, for instance, the track The Feedback, it's been sampled by a lot of musicians, and I'm wondering if he's aware of the influence and how it's been sampled.
Sì, certamente sì. Però bisogna specificare una cosa.
I am aware of this, of course, and the important thing that you have to point out and understand about this is that, you know, people who composed music, they composed music freely with a certain freedom, and then people actually played and performed the music. They used to perform it with the same freedom, so it was music out of control.
Eseguite con la libertà. Allora noi ci siamo detti.
One of the things that is so wonderful about your music is the way you incorporate a lot of non-traditional sounds. Dissonance, of course, but also, you know, electronic sound, you know, environmental sounds, that sort of thing. How did you get inspired to have such a broad palette?
Qualcosa è rimasto del gruppo, dell'esperienza del gruppo.
Well, of course, something of the experience of the group remained. Plus, I had an experience, very interesting one, with two French engineers who actually had recorded music, or let's call it music, with environment sounds, for example, the firefighter sirens, horse riding, traffic jams, etc., this kind of music, this kind of sounds, and they just did a recording only with these things. So that led me to believe that, you know, by putting environment music, or, for example, animal sounds, sounds into music, you could get something more out of it.
Uno degli esempi evidenti ce ne sono moltissimi.
Just to give you an example, the animal sound in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly by Leone, I used a coyote howl.
È il tema del film. Il tema
so the exact sound, that is the theme of the film. So as you can see, you can use this kind of music, and I personally used it like an improvement for myself and for my own music and composition.
È sempre utile, qualsiasi, anche la più avanguardista.
There are so many films that I would want to talk about. I wonder if we could just talk about the mission. And what's remarkable to me about that is that the use of the native instruments and sounds, the South American sounds that, frankly, in less talented hands could sound like a gimmick, but you integrate it so beautifully. I'm wondering how you approached that original music.
The music is actually conditioned by the period in which the film was set, which is 1750. So, of course, the Jesuits went to South America to teach Christianity to these people. They also brought with them the musical tradition, in that particular case, instrumental music, for example, Gabriel with his oboe. Another aspect I had to take into account was choral music, for example. And the third element is, as you were saying, native music. So in the film, at the beginning of the film, for example, aspect one and two had to be combined together. Then aspect one and three had to be combined together. Then two and three had to be combined together. And then at the end of the film, I had to combine all three elements of this music together. And that was not really easy.
Un esercizio combinatorio non facile.
Ennio Morricone is 85 years old and still composing. He spoke to us from his house in Rome. Ennio Morricone, thank you so much.
Grazie a lei, delle domande interessanti.
Burt Bacharach, Carole King, Holland Dozier and Holland. Many of the hit-making songwriters of the 1960s are remembered by name. But do you know who wrote these classics? All those songs were written or co-written by record producer Burt Burns. His little-known story is told in a new book by Joel Selvin called Here Comes the Night. Burns lived the credo: eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. For good reason. Doctors told Burt Burns at an early age that death was never far away. Here's Joel Selvin.
When Burt Burns was 14 years old in 1945, he suffered rheumatic fever, scarred his heart. He was told he wouldn't live to be 21 years old. He dropped out of school and pretty much became a ne'er-do-well. He had some vague show business ambitions, but he didn't get into songwriting and the professional music business until 1959, when he was 30 years old.
And you write about how the shadow of his illness comes across in the lyrics of a lot of his songs.
It's the first thing I noticed that attracted me to Burns' music, is he is a songwriter and record producer and wants to push his singers to the edge of despair, right at the dawn of hysteria. That's when I discovered the pathology behind it. He had a line for a song that he wanted to finish, and he took it to Jerry Ragavoy. And Jerry and he had written a bunch of songs together, and Ragavoy heard the line and said, yeah, and sort of worked out the rest of the song. The line Burns had was, take it, take another little piece of my heart. He was dead within 6 months. He recorded it with Irma Franklin, Aretha's sister. It was probably his last really big hit record.
Something else that's fascinating about him, which is a really important factor in his story and the story of the music, was he spent some time in Cuba, in pre-revolutionary Cuba.
Well, Burns was smitten with Latin music at an early age, and when he tripped across the combination of mambo and rock and roll, That's when he found his voice. My Girl Sloopy is one of the most pure Afro-Cuban R&B experiences ever to hit the charts.
Let's talk about the first of those Burt Burns songs that everybody has heard. Twist and Shout falls in that category. I had no idea till I read your book that it was based on La Bamba.
He loved La Bamba. He rewrote La Bamba many times. Twist and Shout was the first song that Burns demonstrated to Atlantic Records partner Jerry Wexler when he met Wexler, who would be one of the key figures in his career. And Wexler took the piece of material into the studio with a group called the Top Notes, and a 19-year-old boy wonder was producing that day, a young man named Phil Spector, who was pretty much just as much of a nobody as Burns was. But, you know, it was his day. He was getting the shot. And he felt compelled to take this piece of material with its kind of natural Latin feel and turn it into a blues shuffle. Take it up, baby. That was just as banal and mediocre and just evaporated the value of the song. Burns was furious, and Wexler just told him to shut up. Out of that session, Burns came to the decision that he needed to be the record producer if he was truly going to shepherd his song's creative destinies. And he took the song to the Isley Brothers over at Scepter Records within a year and cut the biggest selling record that Scepter had had that wasn't done by the Shirelles.
Give us a sense of Burt Burns at his peak. How successful was he?
You couldn't have been more successful than Burns. He not only wrote all these hit songs and produced all these hit records, he saved Atlantic Records at a time where they weren't selling anything, and he developed Solomon Burke and the Drifters Under the Boardwalk. He started his own label, Bang Records, had a number one record within months, and started the careers of Neil Diamond and Van Morrison. He was making hit records, living in a penthouse, and had a fishbowl stuffed with royalty checks he was too busy to take to the bank.
My guest is Joel Selvin, author of Here Comes the Night, The Dark Soul of Burt Burns and the Dirty Business of Rhythm and Blues. You mentioned Jerry Wexler at Atlantic Records. When you first started to talk to him about Burt Burns, tell us what his reaction was.
Neither Wexler nor Atlantic Records founder Ahmed Erigan cared to participate in this book. They both bear Burns a considerable animus. What he said was, "I don't know where he's buried, but if I did, I'd on his grave."
Wow.
He used gangster connections to muscle his way out of a partnership with the Atlantic guys, and they never really forgave him. It's important to understand the relative moral universe in which Burns and the rest of the New York City rhythm and blues independent labels operated. Gangsters were a common part of the scene. It's not often spoken of. It really isn't outside the parameters of kind of everyday business dealings in the dirty business of rhythm and blues.
So Burt Burns starts to unravel a bit. You write about how it's kind of, times are sort of changing, that there had been this distinction between songwriters and singers. They were separate, but now we're getting into a time where he's working with people like Neil Diamond and Van Morrison, and these guys want to have more control over what they're doing.
Burt Burns is all about hit records. And you're right, it was uncommon for artists at that point to have any say over that kind of decision in their career or having an opinion that mattered. Van Morrison, Brown Eyed Girl, was a record Burt Burns understood. You, my brown-eyed girl. And that was a big hit record for Van. It launched his solo career, and it's beautifully produced by Burns. When Van Morrison returned later that year from Ireland to record a second album, the songs he had were the songs that eventually showed up on the album Astral Weeks. Now, we all know Astral Weeks is one of the great poetic visionary albums of our time, but it doesn't sound like a hit record. And Burns was quite frustrated with Van and his artistic instincts. The way that young love was due. there was a lot of conflict. Van broke a guitar in the studio. One of Burns' gangland associates broke a guitar over Van. It was a very difficult relationship. And, of course, as his life is shortening and the symptoms of his heart disease are becoming more pronounced and the pressure is mounting on him with the Atlantic deal going south and the gangster business partners and Neil Diamond and Van Morrison, the whole thing leads to quite a cataclysmic denouement.
And with his end, you know, he died 38 years old, in December of 1967. You know, had he survived, was there any place for him to go? Or it kind of felt like the end, even if he hadn't have died at that time.
One of the things that fascinated me about the Burns story was how his career perfectly encapsulated the height of the New York rhythm and blues scene from 1960 to 1967. You know, when Burns died, it was all over. Soul music would never get greater than Aretha Franklin. Lieber and Stoller had retired. Phil Spector was living as a recluse. Goffin and King had split up. Doc Pomus, one of the great songwriters of the era, was running poker games in a Fleabag hotel on Broadway. It was just the end of the era. Nobody knew it at the time.
Wow, here it comes.
Joel Selvin's new book is called Here Comes the Night: The Dark Soul of Burt Burns and the Dirty Business of Rhythm and Blues. Joel Selvin, thanks. This was fascinating.
Thank you very much.
For the week ending May 25th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Tom Dreisbach, Becky Hersher, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, Becky Sullivan, and Alexis Kenyon. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leo DeLagula and Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.